at Naked Scientists, or you can find us on our Facebook page.
Now, for most professional rugby or American football players, repeated knocks to the head are considered an occupational hazard. But over the course of a career, they can result in long-term damage. Now scientists have developed a new theory that means that there might be more we can do to protect players beyond fitting them with a helmet.
To find out more, we're joined by Dr. Geoffrey Bazarian from the University of Rochester Medical Centre. Hello, Geoffrey.
Hi.
Tell us, first of all, what did we used to think happened when people were subjected to repeated blows to the head?
Well, we've only begun to actually see a connection between these repeated blows and something bad happening. People kind of think if there's something bad happening, it involves stretching the long spaghetti-like cells in the brain, the neurons, and causing axonal damage. And just doing that repeatedly at a low level over and over and over again. And so the thinking has been that the damage kind of builds up in time, some critical threshold is reached, and you get dementia later in life.
So it's just because if you keep on shaking the head too hard, you're going to sever nerve cell axons, these connections, and eventually you're going to lose cells, lose connections, and this will have a cognitive decrement.
That's exactly right.
So what are you saying is different?
Well, it looks like the problem might be not so much with injuring the brain cells, but injuring the gate between the brain and the blood. This barrier is called the blood-brain barrier. The brain is kind of a funny organ. It's walled off from the rest of the body by this barrier, and it's normally closed. And our study suggests that these blows to the head that we don't think about being bad repeatedly open up that barrier and allow proteins to kind of bathe the brain to get out into the peripheral circulation, which doesn't sound so bad. But the main discovery here is we found antibodies. The body actually makes antibodies to those proteins. So the next time that gate opens up, that antibody's looking for a target. It's like a heat-seeking missile looking for a target. And where does it go? It goes back to the cell that made the protein to begin with, back into the brain across this breached blood-brain barrier. And we speculate that may be part of the process of this long-term neurodegeneration.
What evidence have you got that, A, the blood-brain barrier is opening up in that way when there is head trauma or repeated trauma, and B, that those antibodies are then actually going across the blood-brain barrier later and doing damage?
Excellent questions. So the first question you posed was actually more easy to demonstrate. Using this blood test called S100B, this is a protein that's made by astrocytes in the brain. It's not found anywhere else. So the blood-brain barrier's got to be open for this stuff to show in the serum. So we can't actually visualize the blood-brain barrier in someone who's alive. You can only do it post-mortem. So this is a kind of a surrogate measure of blood-brain barrier patency. And if you see this protein above a certain level, the blood-brain barrier is open. And we kind of established some of those thresholds in prior studies. So that part was easy. Showing antibodies to the protein, that was easy. Your second question, that was much harder to prove, right? We can't actually see these antibodies on living brain tissue. There's no way to kind of image that in someone who's alive. If they were willing, we could take a piece of their brain out and look at it under the microscope, but most folks who play football aren't really interested in doing that. So we have to do some work with animals. We took the blood from some of these athletes that have the antibodies, poured it over mouse brain, and saw that it stuck to the cells that we thought expressed this. It's a leap to kind of say, well, it's probably happening in the human brain, but we saw it in the animal. So it makes the connection a little easier to make, but by no means causative.
What is it going to take to prove this now that you have this intellectual leap and you've got some evidence that certainly the antibodies are being made, and can we stop it?
Right. I think that's where we probably have to turn to an animal model. You know, how you establish causality in these cases is you do the typical things. You try to block the antibody response, see if the brain injury is prevented. You try to stimulate the antibody response, see if you get more brain injury. You sacrifice the animal, look to see if the antibody is sticking to the cells in a more direct way. In humans, it's going to be very difficult to prove that link unless somebody can come up with a kind of a non-invasive way to image these antibody complexes on the brain.
What about professional footballers? Are we going to see them being told, whatever you do, don't head the ball in future because could get brain damage?
That's a little different question, and I think there's a lot of people, myself included, trying to tighten that connection, trying to show that whatever happens acutely with these subconcussive head blows, that they somehow are directly linked to neurodegeneration 10 or 15 years later. That's kind of difficult to do because of the time involved. But I think we need to connect a few more of those dots before we start telling footballers to not hit 70, 80 times a game.
But how hard do you think you have to hit your head in order to get this effect? Or is it really rather trivial head trauma that will do this?
Well, that's an excellent question. And that's exactly the kind of things that need to be established. And, you know, luckily, with the invention of sensors, accelerometers for helmets, for football players, we can start to answer what threshold needs to be reached before we start to see some either an abnormal immune response or some microscopic brain injury. So that work is being done. It's harder to do in rugby players or in soccer players because we can't really measure the forces to their head without them wearing some kind of sensors on their head. They don't wear helmets, so that makes it harder to do. But there's many people that are hot on the trail of this question.
Jeffrey, thank you. We'll have to leave it there. I'm just donning my helmet to protect my head now. That's Dr. Jeffrey Bizarin from the University of Rochester Medical Center. You're listening to The Naked Scientist with Ginny Smith and with me, Chris Smith.
If you'd like to get in touch with any questions or comments, email chris@thenakedscientists.com.